From the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end of what's really happening in your old North State.
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. I'm here with Brooke Medina. We're going to talk what a lot of people are thinking about in the political world, the November midterm elections, especially related to North Carolina, the ABC liquor scandal, and school safety. We're going to talk that and a few other things. Let's get started. Brooke, are you excited about the election?
I am. I am excited. I am in a bit of a junkie when it comes to just watching debates, election debates and things like that. So been following the various races and curious to see how everything shakes out in the elections in November.
Absolutely. I think I've always been fascinated with elections. I loved watching them on TV as a kid. That's kind of how I've got a little bit interested in politics from the get-go. In my kindergarten class, we voted on Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan. I know I'm dating myself a little bit. And
who are those people?
Yeah, exactly.
Just kidding.
And I just remember that Ronald Reagan won by a landslide. I'm sure every kid was voting for who their parent was voting for. But it was kind of exciting. And ever since that, I remember just the 1988 race when Al Gore ran for president. Joe Biden ran for president. People forget, but he was caught up in a plagiarism scandal. And there was Gary Hart, who was a senator. And he had an affair with Donna Rice. And that was big news when I was a little kid. So I just remember watching all this presidential election stuff as a kid and always being kind of fascinated by it. And so elections to me are exciting. We got two House races in North Carolina that I think are going to pique a lot of people's interest. One got moved on the Cook Political Report, I think just early this week, was District 9 in North Carolina with Mark Harris and Dan McCready. It was lean Republican, and it got moved to being a toss-up. And then, of course, District 13, Kathy Manning is challenging incumbent Republican Ted Budd, who's a member of, I think, help me out here, the
Freedom Caucus?
Freedom Caucus, yes, one of my favorite groups in Congress that deals with fiscal responsibility and other issues. But we did a Civitas poll in July that showed Ted Budd with a 5-point lead over Kathy Manning. Of course, Kathy Manning and both Dan McCready are outraising the Republicans, Mark Harris and Ted Budd. So they'll be very interesting races. They're going to be both very competitive. And if I was making a prediction today, I would say that Dan McCready would beat the Republican Mark Harris. Of course, he knocked off Rich Pittenger in that primary. And then Ted Budd, I think, will beat, in the end, Kathy Manning, although I think that'll be very close. But I think the Civitas poll, which, of course, is just a snapshot, will show that in the end, he will prevail on Election Day. So,
well, and perhaps we will get some better guidance as to whether or not those predictions are going to bear out. Because we are polling unaffiliated voters come next week, actually. So our annual unaffiliated voter poll lunch is next week. And so it will be interesting to see how this is the fastest voting block or fastest growing voting block in the state. So it'll be interesting to see what their sentiments are right now and how they're feeling. But also we'll be doing some more statewide polling in October and November as well. So and September, actually. So, you know, we're making some predictions and we'll see if they pan out the way we're expecting. But I tend to agree with you. I think the Manning Bud one, I think it's going to be a little bit closer than what we're anticipating, so I'm not comfortable with actually making a projection yet.
Right.
I think it's fascinating in this race. We have a Libertarian and Green Party candidate as well, so there are four candidates on the ballot for this race, so that's pretty neat. But the Libertarian and Green Party candidates are each taking 3%. So my guess is which is pretty obvious. Bud's some of the Libertarians are pulling from Bud's otherwise supporters, and the same with Manning on the Green Party. That's just a guess, but probably more so the case. But let's go to this NC9 race. So you said that this just recently became a toss-up district, according to Cook Political Report.
Yep.
Give our listeners an idea of why this is probably now a toss-up compared to where before it was definitely lean Republican.
Yeah, I think part of it has to do with Mark Harris's comments where he talked about women needing to be submissive in a sermon that I think was dug up by opponents, obviously, and special interests that are helping Dan McCready. And that's one reason. McCready has raised a lot more money. I don't know a ton about his background. I know he's a war veteran. He's a very attractive candidate for many people. So I think he's moderating his tone some on the Democrat side. And so that's going to have appeal to many swing voters. So if they can effectively tag Mark Harris as being sort of this stodgy minister who, you know, at least they're able to perceive him as being anti-woman to some degree, then, you know, McCready would be very successful. And I think just the amount of money they're raising and a lot of this, some of this is going to have to do with, you know, Trump's popularity in the district. And Trump's, you know, he's underwater in a lot of these districts. And so Democrats in taking back the House are counting on Trump's unpopularity being a big factor in a lot of these races. So I think some of that will play in that factor as well.
Absolutely. I would say that that's something that many candidates on the Republican side are trying to toe this line as to how far they support the president right. while distancing themselves. It just really depends on that particular district. Mark Harris's district, part of them are in the Charlotte area. Mm. And so that will impact certain demographics of his voters or would-be voters.
I saw something in Politico that was interesting that the Trump campaign basically said, hey, if you want us to come to your district, we will try to get there. But if you want us to have a hands-off approach, then we'll have a hands-off approach. Let's just real briefly look at one other story. I saw the Democrats are trying, some Democrats are trying to get rid of Nancy Pelosi. They don't want to be, they don't want her to be speaker if the Democrats win back control of Congress. And I'll make a prediction here that I think Democrats by maybe 10 to 12 seats at least will regain control of the House of Representatives. I don't think that they will regain control of the Senate, but I think they will take over the House. And so that'll be interesting. A lot of Republicans think that's not necessarily a bad thing. They think that maybe Democrats will overreach. And with Pelosi, who's not very popular nationally, you know, that she may lose the House again when Trump runs for re-election. So that's always a possibility. So do you have any thoughts on Pelosi as trying to remove her as Speaker? Because I think this is a shrewd move by Democrats. I think they realize that, you know, Pelosi's not very popular and they want to go in a different direction, at least have a different image, you know, at
well,
the top.
Well, they might want a different image. On the other hand, though, Pelosi's great at fundraising for them. So they're having to toe a line as well. And that's obviously more at the national level, I would say, when they're thinking of optics and how it would look to support Pelosi for another round another try at the speakership will be something that each candidate's going to have to make their own decision on whether or not that plays well with their base. But, you know, I'm not a fan of Pelosi. I think that she doesn't come across as very natural or authentic. But part of that is when you're in Washington as long as she's been, you're going to become a little bit robotic, right?
Yeah. And she's definitely not like a folk hero of the left anymore, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I read an article, I think it was early this week, that there's a big movie coming out about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and there's an action figure coming out now. So, you know, Pelosi hasn't been able to.
Oh, I can't wait to see what that looks like.
Yeah, no, you can go online. If anybody's at home in front of their computer, go and Google Ruth Bader Ginsburg action figure.
So is she going to have her Supreme Court gown on and like her pretty collar and stuff? And
she's become this sort of like folk hero for the left in many ways where I think.
Right, you know, I could see that.
Know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, she was just kind of made fun of as this person that fell asleep in the chambers, but now because of her importance with the nomination of Kavanaugh and she's this big figure on the left, and because of her age, you know, they have workout videos her online and stuff trying to keep her healthy. It just shows you that, you know,
people have even offered to donate their organs to her to prolong her life.
And 50 years ago, most Americans couldn't even name a member of the court, and it just shows you how politicized everything's become in our judiciary too. And so and that way I think it's a bad thing, but it is funny to see this sort of heroic nature of of Ginsburg today, but Pelosi hasn't really been able to get into that aura or to draw upon that aura. She's kind of an unpopular figure. Even in the Democratic Party, there's a big segment in the House that wants to replace her, wants to go maybe with a younger figure and show that, you know, not all of our stars in our party are in our 70s and almost 80s.
Yeah, well, time will tell, and actually we won't have to wait that long, will we? November is right around the corner.
Yeah, and so we'll talk more about elections coming up, and we'll certainly talk more about some of the House races in North Carolina and in the legislature and in the Senate too. We'll address that in upcoming podcasts. So have you followed this ABC liquor store story scandal in North Carolina? It's getting a lot of attention. I don't remember his first name, but there was a resignation today by one of the commissioners. I think his name was Henniger.
Herring, I think.
Herring, that's right, Herring. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and he was going out guns blazing.
He was totally guns a-blazing. Have to respect him a little bit for
down. He was not going to take any of that, and he threw the flag on the assertions made by the auditor and Governor Cooper. He attacked him as well. It's interesting, though, because although he might be indignant, the fact of the matter is that $13 million $13 million of taxpayer money, mind you, was being wasted at the ABC Commission, and that was just as a result of poor oversight and unwise decisions by them. So taxpayers have a right to be upset about this. This is a scandal, and in respect to how money was mismanaged, and that's a problem. Not to mention the contract. So ABC warehouse contractor that called LBMB, they were in a multi-million dollar federal fraud case. This is a story from Carolina Journal by Carrie Travis, an excellent journalist, and she digs into really what this LBMB, who was contracted by ABC, ended up settling for at the federal level. And it begs the question that did the ABC Commission actually know about that case? I mean, right. It's $7.8 million. You'd think they would research who they're going into contract with before they hire them on. And so there's just a bunch of questions and red flags that have been raised. But I want to hear from you, Ray. What do you think about ABC even existing here in the state of North Carolina?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. It's such a relic from the past. I wonder, because we have so many new people moving into North Carolina, and they come to North Carolina and move here for the first time, and they kind of wondering, what's going on here with this ABC stuff? And so it's only in 17 other states, and it's different in each state to some degree. But North Carolina has a very antiquated system where that C stands for control, and you know, you have a monopoly in North Carolina with ABC in terms of the spirits and the liquors that are sold. They own the warehouses, they own they control the commission, and they own all of that liquor. They set the prices, so you have a monopoly. We shouldn't, to me, it just seems like privatizing the system makes the most sense. Getting a government out of the liquor selling business makes the most sense. Whatever you think about hard liquor or spirits, to me, it just makes the most sense to privatize this system, because it really is an antiquated system from the past, from the Prohibition era, really. And so,
right.
See it as something that needs to be reformed, and I think should easily be reformed. I know the legislature has made a few steps in terms of Sunday sales, and they allow you now to buy one bottle of spirit if you tour a distillery. But I mean, there's been no evidence, Brooke, that when there's a reform on this issue, when you privatize the sale of liquor, that it has any, you know, upticks in DUIs or domestic abuse or violence or things of that nature. So you'd get rid of the price controls. You'd get rid of the more expensive beverages. You'd have more of a free market. And I think that's something that's needed in North Carolina. And I don't think you'll see any negative effects of that if you were to do that. That's my opinion there.
And there's a case to be made even to those who maybe don't believe that liquor sales should occur, or just have personal moral convictions against it. And that's the fact that government is actually the one selling people liquor. There's a case to be made against that. So if you have that sort of conviction, even you really don't want your tax dollars going toward that. And you and I have discussed this, and I know you said the ABC would say, well, they actually recoup all of the money through sales and things like that. But given that they've mismanaged $13 million, I wouldn't put it past them to have mismanaged some of the other revenue that they've made.
That's really the bigger picture is that
I'm
there's
skeptical.
No, yeah, you should be skeptical. That's the bigger picture is that the lack of oversight in this. I don't think it's something that will change. So, you know, that's a concern.
Yeah, for sure. But one thing, I was reading this article by Will Duran in the News and Observer, and he was just giving a little bit of history and just opening up the discussion regarding privatizing liquor sales. And he was talking about the famous temperance crusader named Carrie Nation. So if you've, I don't know if you've ever heard that name before.
I have heard that name. I don't know a lot about her.
So yeah, so she was somebody advocated for temperance, prohibition, things like that. She came to North Carolina in 1907 and said that Salisbury was second only to Chicago as the whiskiest soaked city in the United States. Now, when I'm thinking of a whiskiest soaked city, which I've never heard of that before, but or heard of it referred to as that, Salisbury does not come to mind as like the top of my list when I'm thinking of that. So I wonder what Salisbury looked like in 1907.
Well, I know that North Carolina has a rich history of moonshining, and of course NASCAR got part of its start with some of the rum runners and moonshine runners across the state racing their cars. So, you know, there's a great, I love bluegrass music. There's some great bluegrass songs about moonshining in the hills of North Carolina and Virginia and other Appalachian states. So to me, you know, I think in some ways it's okay to embrace, you know, more of a free market approach when it comes to liquor sales. And the good thing is that the government, I think, can create more revenue because I think sales would uptick. So that's one positive. And I think, too, if you're someone that doesn't like spirits, doesn't like hard liquor, then, you know, there's always a moral case that is something you should abstain from. So, you know, there's two sides to this issue to some degree. But I think the people that just want to go with the status quo are really wrong on this. And you're not going to see any upticks in immorality or things like that just from privatizing the system and making it more accessible.
So apparently in Pat McCrory in his last election made this part of his platform was to abolish ABC, which I thought was interesting. I read about that. Governor Cooper has not actually, he's been relatively quiet on where he stands when it comes to this topic. Although, you know, at the beginning of this conversation, we talked about Herring, who was just turned in his resignation at ABC stores, and he blasted the governor because he felt like the Governor Cooper was not supporting ABC like he should have been, in his opinion. So, you know, it's interesting to see how politics plays a role in liquor.
There's a lot of special interest in the ABC monopoly. System, there's a lot of special interests. There's a lot of lobbyists who want to keep the status quo. I know in Pennsylvania, another state that has a system similar to North Carolina, you know, there's been promises. Republicans said they're going to go in and create reform and privatize the system. And they're never able to because of just the amount of control that certain counties have, that certain special interest groups. So it's a very hard reform. But I think it's a reform that'll happen at some point in North Carolina because it is such an antiquated system. And because I think because the rise of distilleries and the rise of spirits, that you'll see more reform, but I think eventually that this system will be privatized, and I think that'll be a positive for North Carolina overall.
Yeah, I agree.
Get government out of the liquor business. I mean, when they were involved with it in Prohibition, it didn't work out so well either.
It didn't, I couldn't agree with you more. Amen. A hearty and resounding one at that. But okay, so we've talked about liquor. I want to talk to you about cantaloupes and the world.
That's kind of a letdown. You went from liquor to cantaloupes.
Unless you really like cantaloupes, which in my case I do not. So
yeah, I like them all right. I like watermelon more. But so what about this cantaloupe?
So North Carolina farmer actually grew the biggest cantaloupe in the world. It set the world record at 65.9 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was at the center of attention at the state farmers market over here in Raleigh area. And yeah, the old record was 64.8 pounds. So he beat it by 1.1 pounds, and that person was an Alaskan farmer that held the previous record. So can you imagine that much cantaloupe?
Could you eat that much cantaloupe? I think that's the more important question.
I can't imagine even eating a bite of cantaloupe. I cannot stand the stuff.
Really? Ugh. Why not? Because to me, it doesn't have a strong taste, really.
I don't like the texture of it. I don't like any melon texture. It's just a little too gritty with the water and watery. I'm just not a fan of it. But if it were avocado, I would totally be down.
Have you ever watched these eating contests on TV?
I used to when I was a kid. Yes, yeah.
I used to watch the Kobayashi, the Japanese guy. I know there's a new ruler. I can't remember his name because I don't follow as much anymore. But it's amazing how some of these people can just put away food like that. So a cantaloupe eating contest. I wonder if there's a record for most cantaloupe.
You should look that up right now. I can't imagine devoting all those calories to cantaloupe. If I'm going to eat something in excess, I'm going to make it really good. And I'm talking like cheesecake from the Cheesecake Factory, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. I don't know, lots of coffee, something like that.
The first thing that came up was infections associated with cantaloupe consumption.
Oh, what kind of infections?
Okay, most watermelon eaten in 30s. I'm not finding anything for cantaloupe, but...
What's the watermelon one?
This is only for 30 seconds. This may not be that interesting. Most watermelon eaten in 30 seconds is 1.1 pounds. It was achieved by Dinesh
Upadhyaya
in India.
But okay, so that's 30 seconds, 1 pound in 30 seconds. That's pretty impressive. So I don't know how you do that. I wonder what his secret was.
Someone ate a 15-pound watermelon in 23 minutes and 7 seconds. Sam Stilson of Toronto.
Those Ontario. Canadians.
Yeah.
Know how to eat some watermelon, apparently. So, anyways, I just thought that was a fun, interesting fact and something that the good old North State can be proud of.
Absolutely.
World record-setting cantaloupe. But let's pivot to school safety before we run out of time for this week's episode. So there was an interesting study released recently, and it has to do with the disparity or the chasm between school safety in private schools and that of public schools.
Yeah, it's a big issue.
It is a big issue, and there are plenty of arguments by those on the left. I know because I've seen them after I posted an article about this on nccivitas.org. But the arguments, you know, are tried and true against school choice and private school students. I know one person even tweeted, we should abolish private schools because it perpetuates classism, which I thought was absolutely hilarious. If we follow that logic, what else should we be abolishing?
Yeah,
targets because, you know, people should only get to shop at Walmart. I mean, come on. So anyways, it's an emotionally charged topic to be sure, but it is something that if you're a parent or grandparent, you care about the safety of your children as they go away to school each day. Yeah. And so we've been trying to problem solve as a state and as a nation, how best to protect our students, especially in the wake of Parkland shooting, which was the most recent. And it's not something that we want to have to grapple with. We wish we could just send our kids home or, you know, to school each day and expect to see them back at home at the end of it.
Yeah, we should never have to worry about kids in school.
It should not be a concern. Yeah. But the reality on the ground is that it is.
Yeah, we live in a fallen world, and it's unfortunate that so much crime is being manifested in these horrific ways.
It is. And I mean, there are policy proposals out there. Some people advocate for arming teachers. I think there's a case to be made against that.
Yeah, I can see both sides.
Yeah, I can too. But I do think that I'm more against it than I am for it. So if somebody disagrees with me, I welcome you to just email, voice your opinion. And
would you be okay if the teacher was a firearm instructor, say, for the NRA and taught courses on concealed carry with them carrying a firearm?
Possibly. I mean, I'd be more open to it if I knew that the teacher was proficient, but that's not necessarily my only issue with it. It has to do with the fact that someone else could overpower that teacher, or that teacher may not be as conscious of where their weapon is at all times. Is it always on their person? Is it ever in their purse or their desk where someone else could have access to it?
Yeah, the problem is if there's one time or something, you know, whether it be an accidental discharge or one small thing, that it could probably sabotage any of those proposals or any of those plans. I know some states have already done it, though. So, you know, I haven't heard of problems in other states where that's been done yet, but
So I guess it will be something to monitor to see how that bears out in the years ahead, and maybe it is something that we can consider in the future, North Carolina. But in the meantime, this study found that private schools are markedly safer than public schools, even after controlling for things like school teacher ratio, school size, percent of minority teachers, percent of minority students, urbanicity. All those things were controlled for, and even still, government schools were about 28% more likely to find a student in possession of a weapon, 18% more likely to have gang activity on campus, whereas private schools were 13% less likely to experience racial tensions. I thought that was pretty fascinating, even after controlling for race. Private schools were also 12% less likely to use illegal drugs. So there's a case to be made for, I would say, school choice when you're looking at this kind of research. You're able to see that that there is a school environment that is statistically significantly proven to provide a safer environment. And so why would we prevent access from children for children accessing that particular education?
But why is it a safer environment?
Why is it? Well, I don't know if the study drew those particular conclusions.
I think that's an important question. I wonder if people who would be against private schools or even public charter schools or just alternatives to public education might say, well, hey, Brooke, there's a problem with those schools because they get to be more selective. Private schools get to be more selective. They don't have to take everybody. So I wonder if looking at that, and they say, "Hey, we can't be like private schools because we have to take every student."
Right. That is an argument that I have heard on that front. And there is an aspect of it where private schools do get to be more selective. The question is, are we going to make other kids that are well-behaved students that are willing to abide by rules sit in unsafe environments or less safe environments just because, we feel like everything has to be so even that everybody is even in like misery or even in lack of access to safety or things like that. So, government policies always are going to be very broad. They're going to they're going to affect the most people possible at a very general, broad level. And most students are not problem students. And so expanding school choice would be an opportunity for those students. I would say the average student to be able to attend a school where they felt safe. And that's a priority for parents. That is something that in the research consistently ranks up there with academic performance, actually even outpacing academic performance when it comes to parental stuff that parents prioritize when they're choosing a school for their child. So there's a case to be made, I would say, for at least further research when it comes to that private school safety aspect. And as a parent, I know that's something I'm very much interested in and I'm going to continue to watch.
Yeah, school choice to me makes sense. I mean, I've told you this before, but when I was in public school in Mississippi, I think one frustrating thing for me was 10th through 12th grade. I went to what was supposed to be one of the better public schools in the state. I know that's not saying a ton for Mississippi. There are some good public schools there. But, I was in a class, 11th grade English class, and there's just so much misbehavior. I was in a math class where there were kids smoking out the window in the back. They were fighting, mooning the teacher when their back, was to the classroom. And I just remember just being frustrated because I was like, there's so much disruption in the class. Sometimes these kids might get kicked out or suspended for a day or two, but the situation would come back to be the same thing a couple of days later. And it was just really frustrating because you really couldn't learn much. There wasn't any discipline. And to me, that just was not so unfair to all the other students.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that a lot of kids, unfortunately, are having to kind of trudge through in their whole school experience when they're really wanting to learn and they're having to contend with an unsafe environment or an environment where there's a bunch of unruly students and things like that. So anyways, we will be continuing to, see if more research comes out on that. But as always, a lot of what we've discussed, we've also written about on ncivitas.org.
There's a lot of content up there.
Absolutely. And you can also find previous episodes of Civit Talk on there. So if you just go to nccivitas.org and type in CIVITALK, that will give you access to previous episodes of our podcast. And also, we would love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback from today's show, you disagree with me on not liking cantaloupe or disagree with Ray's political elections projections, just go ahead and email us at radio@nccivitas.org. Thanks and have a good week.
Thank you.